All right. Well, thank you so much. Welcome to the Gold Circle event of the Council for National Policy. And we welcome you. We've got a great weekend lined up. You are going to know just about everything from A to Z and what's happening by the time you leave here on Sunday morning. So welcome. I'm going to jump right into this as we introduce our first guest to speak to us during our reception. Many of you know Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, one of the great conservative leaders that we have in the United States Senate. Tom served in the House prior to coming to the Senate, but his story is coming from Arkansas. He worked on the family cattle farm and then went to Harvard, where he got his law degree. And then, after 9/11, realized he needed to serve his country, so he served for 5 years in the United States Army, was with the Army Rangers, was a captain, actually, he's got a book that you're going to get a copy. This will be at your table upstairs for dinner. Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. And so he's actually been on a book tour up in New York this week and elsewhere, and he lives here, his family's here, and so as they finish business today at the Capitol, he agreed to come by and greet you and spend a few minutes with us. And so he's going to speak, and then he's going to take a few questions from you before we go up for dinner. So would you please welcome our good friend, Senator Tom Cotton.
Thank you all very much for the warm welcome. It's good to be back with the Council for National Policy. Tony, thank you very much for that kind introduction. And Bob, thank you very much for your leadership as well. As Tony said, I've got a book out just a couple days ago. I would tell you it's available for order on Amazon, but you are going to get a copy tonight. So once you read it and figure out how great it is, you can buy some for your friends on Amazon. I just want to give you a little bit of a taste of what the book is about. You know, a lot of politicians write a book about themselves and their story. They write a book about their plan for America. I didn't do either one of those things because I wanted my book to be interesting that you'd want to read, not end up in the remainder bin very quickly. This is the story of the Old Guard of Arlington National Cemetery. It's a unit where I served for about 16 months between my time in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there's no place I would have rather served, nothing I would have rather have done stateside than have served at the Old Guard. The Old Guard is literally the Old Guard of the Army. It was founded in 1784 as the first American regiment. That means it's 3 years older than our Constitution. And for 160 plus years, it was on the front lines defending our nation. It was fighting in the Northwest Indian Wars, which finally ejected the British from the United States and into Canada. It received the name, the Old Guard, about 60 years later from General Winfield Scott, along whom it had fought in the Battle of 1812 in Mexico City, when to lead the victory parade, General Scott, maybe in recognition of his fighting with the Old Guard 30 years earlier, had put them at the head of the victory parade, and then as they marched past the reviewing stand, he turned around and told his staff, "Gentlemen, take off your hats to the Old Guard of the Army." But it would have deserved the honor regardless, given its valorous performance in the Mexican-American War. It was on both major campaigns, the Monterey Campaign in 1846 and the Mexico City Campaign in 1847. It fought in the Battle of Monterey as captured by a young lieutenant who fought alongside them, noting that they had taken more casualties than any other regiment in the very tough Battle of Monterey. That lieutenant was Ulysses S. Grant. And then the next year, after it had moved down to Veracruz and began the march up to Mexico City, Santa Ana dug in on the high ground outside of Cerro Gordo on both sides of the pass on the way to Mexico City, surrounded by ravines and jungle, confident that no one could flank him. But in fact, the Old Guard and two other regiments did flank him and attack him from his rear, killing or capturing thousands of Mexican soldiers in the battle that really ended the Mexican-American War for all intents and purposes. When they were going around in that bold flanking movement, their pathfinder was a young captain engineers named Robert E. Lee. Then 15 years later, they found themselves on the opposite side of a war with that young captain of engineers, a man who had become the commander of the major Confederate army in the East. They were known as the regulars, In those days, we didn't have many soldiers under arms. We had a small cadre of professional soldiers that were known as the regulars. Most of the rest of our wars were fought by state volunteer regiments. And the Old Guard fought alongside their fellow regulars in every major battle, from the first battle of Bull Run to Gettysburg, where on the second day they were in the bloody wheat field. I know many of you know your military history, and you know that in the wheat field is where the Union forces prevented Lee from breaking through the Union lines. A young volunteer soldier observing from the Round Top Hills nearby said of those regulars fighting there, "For 2 years, the regulars taught us how to fight like soldiers. And in the wheat field, they taught us how to die like soldiers." And then as the Civil War came to a close, they found themselves in the headquarters of then General Grant, standing at Appomattox Courthouse as their old pathfinder, General Robert E. Lee, surrendered. Most of those volunteer soldiers went home, back to their plows, back to their factories, but not the Old Guard, not the other regulars. The Old Guard continued out to the frontier, moving west as America moved west, fighting in Cuba during the Spanish-American War, and then going even further west to the Philippines, twice during the Philippine insurrection in the early 1900s. They fought underneath the famed American General John Blackjack Pershing when they were in the Philippines. They fought in places like Jolo and Mindanao against Muslim radicals, the exact same places that Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have franchises operating today. And then in World War II, they actually guarded the southern border. After Pancho Villa had conducted raids into New Mexico, killing 18 American citizens. World War II, they ended up, after the Battle of the Bulge, deploying to Northern Europe, conducting occupation duty, guarding prisoners of war in Germany until 1946. But after the war, the Army assigned its oldest regiment to its most sacred ground, Arlington National Cemetery. If you've been to that cemetery, and I suspect most of you have been, you'll notice that its seal says our nation's most sacred shrine. And I have to say, there's good reason for that. Arlington seems, if I could borrow from Tocqueville in another setting, destined by some secret design of Providence to become our national cemetery. That land truly is sacred ground. It was virgin forest in the 1770s when it was bought by the adopted son of George Washington. As many of you know, Martha Washington was widowed as a young woman, had two surviving children. One son, known as Jackie, was raised at Mount Vernon. He revered his father. Knew his father had fought bravely in the French and Indian War and was a respected local leader. Jackie had a young child of his own. He inherited his lands from his mother and he moved back down to the Virginia Tidewater, but he was homesick for his mom and his adopted father and Mount Vernon, the only home he had known. So he decided he'd move back up to Northern Virginia. And he wrote to his adopted father in the winter of 1778, who wrote back to him in a series of correspondence from Valley Forge, advising his young and somewhat naive son on how to negotiate for land at a time when inflation ran into the triple digits, and telling him that he was probably going to get a bad deal. But ultimately, he did, in fact, buy the land that is now Arlington National Cemetery. Sadly, our moment of national triumph, the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, was a moment of tragedy for the Washington family. Jackie contracted a fever at Yorktown and died a few days later, leaving behind his own six-month son. And his grieving parents, Martha and George, adopted that child, the namesake of his adopted grandfather, George Washington Parke Custis, known as Wash. In the same way that his father, Jackie, had been raised by George Washington as his own, now Wash was raised by his own. But now George Washington was not just a brave young warrior and a local, respected local leader. He was the revered General Washington. And then in Jackie's adolescence, he became President Washington. And Wash accompanied him to Philadelphia and then back to Mount Vernon. George Washington passed away in 1799. Martha passed away in 1802. And it just so happens that's when Wash turned 21 and received his inheritance, what is now known as Arlington, but what was then known as Mount Washington. Wash called it that because he had dedicated himself to turning that land into a kind of public memorial for the father of our country. In fact, it was known for most of the early 19th century as Washington's Treasury, not as Arlington. And that was because he built that big house you see up on the hill, if you cross Memorial Bridge, as an homage to Mount Vernon in honor of his revered adopted father. He bought every kind of relic and heirloom and piece of memorabilia from George Washington he could find, from Mount Vernon to his Revolutionary War campaigns to his presidency, usually putting Arlington deep into debt to do so. But he opened the doors to that big mansion and to Arlington as a whole as a way to celebrate the memory of the father of our country. About 30 years later, Arlington got a new resident when his only surviving child, Mary, married a young captain of engineers, Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee moved around the country like officers did in those days. He was an engineer, so he was building forts all up and down the East Coast. He was also deployed out to the frontier. He was the superintendent of troops at West Point for 3 years. But almost every winter, when you couldn't build forts, they would return to Arlington. He'd work in Washington, D.C. at the headquarters of engineers. They raised their family at Arlington. That was the only home they had. When war came in 1861, both the Old Guard and Robert E. Lee found themselves in what was now enemy territory, Texas. They both made their way back to Washington. Robert E. Lee was recalled by the general-in-chief of the Army, something like our chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to be offered a command of the Union Army. Winfield Scott had been his mentor going back to the Mexican-American War. Winfield Scott had called Robert E. Lee the finest soldier I ever saw on the field. When asked what the government should do if war was to come, Winfield Scott had said, "You should ensure the life of Robert E. Lee." But as Winfield Scott expected, Robert E. Lee turned down the command on the spot. And he said, "Lee, this is the worst mistake you've ever made, but I feared it would be so." Advised him to go back to Arlington and to consider resigning his commission. That's what Robert E. Lee did. And on April 22, 1861, he left Arlington and he never returned. And then about a month later, the Union Army crossed the Potomac and they occupied Arlington, and they've held it every single day since then. As the war ground on and more Americans were killed than in every other war we've had combined, cemeteries in the Capitol filled up, the Union Army leadership made the decision to begin to inter soldiers across the river at the old Custis Lee Plantation. We just had the 155th anniversary on Monday, May 13th, of the first soldier buried there, Private William Chrisman, over by the Netherlands, Carillon, and Iwo Jima. They did this in part because they needed the land. They did it also in part because they wanted to ensure that Robert E. Lee could never return to that land. And they knew that their legal claim, having taken it in time of war, was somewhat suspect. In fact, they directed many of the soldiers to be buried specifically on the edges of Mary Lee's rose garden to make the house inhospitable for any future occupation. They were probably right to do that because after the war, after Robert E. Lee passed away and Mary Custis Lee passed away, their claim fell to his firstborn son, who himself was a Confederate officer, but as an illustration of how deep our nation's roots run at that land, was also named George Washington Custis Lee, known as Custis. So Custis filed a lawsuit, and as lawsuits take, it took a very long time. But by 1882, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Lee family in United States v. Lee. Several thousand soldiers were already interred at the cemetery. So what was there to do? Not much besides negotiate a surrender. So for the price of $150,000, Custis signed the deed for what is now Arlington National Cemetery back to the United States government. The man who accepted that deed as the Secretary of War was Robert Todd Lincoln. 18 years after their fathers had waged a terrible civil war against each other, the firstborn sons of both men executed the deed that created our place of national unity and reconciliation. That's why I say that I believe it surely is a secret design of Providence that that land was destined to become our national cemetery. And perhaps it was destined that our nation's oldest regiment was to guard that land, as they have for 71 years since 1948. The Old Guard performs many missions in the Capitol. You've seen many of them in person
at the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. You may have seen them perform ceremonies at the Pentagon or the White House, conduct a color guard at hotels like this. But the one mission they perform that takes priority over everything else are military honor funerals in the cemetery. Funerals first is what we used to say. That was true in our manning and our training and our operating. Anything else could be rescheduled. It could be deprioritized. It could be lightly manned, but not funerals. If there was a family that was expecting to see their loved one honored, then their loved one would be honored. It was a zero fail, no defect mission. Because for the families, those are a once in a lifetime moment, a lifetime in the making. We perform 20 or 30 funerals a day. But for the family, there was only one funeral each day. Today's commander of the Old Guard makes this point. He sometimes shows up at the company that's performing funerals for the day, quietly, just kind of walks in as they're making their final preparations. A young private often sees Colonel Jim Tewitt, startles, calls the room to attention, and he says, "Don't worry, man, I'm just here because there's a very important funeral today." A lot of the soldiers scurry and look at their sheet for the day and try to figure out who the VIP is, but one young soldier usually gets the joke. And he says, "I know what funeral it is, sir. It's every single one." That's the attitude they take forward on our behalf, performing those military honor funerals for our fallen heroes. Nothing stops them. And I mean nothing. On September 11th, 2001, when American Airlines Flight 77 slammed into the Pentagon, just a couple hundred yards away from the southeastern edge of Arlington National Cemetery, the 9 a.m. funerals were already underway. Very shortly, the medical platoon of the Old Guard would be the first soldiers to deploy to a new front in a new kind of war as they went to the Pentagon to provide aid. But the 9 o'clock funerals continued, and the 10 o'clock funerals, and the 11 o'clock funerals, and every funeral all day long, even as aircraft parts from that attack had been blown into the cemetery. For the next 30 days, the Old Guard was deployed with several hundred troops at any given time at the Pentagon, providing security, then helping to recover the remains of our fallen fellow citizens, sort through their personal effects. But at no point was there a funeral missed in Arlington National Cemetery. That standard remains the same today. Driving heat, monsoon-like rain, terrible blizzards, enough to close the cemetery to citizens like us if we were just going there to be among the heroes or see the changing of the guard, but not enough to close it for funerals and the families that are coming to see their loved ones honored. Many of you probably remember in December the state funeral of President George H.W. Bush, in which the Old Guard plays a leading role. When we woke up on the morning of Saturday, December 1st, we learned the news that President Bush had passed. By that point, hundreds of Old Guard soldiers had already received the recall notice and mustered at Fort Myer to begin to execute the state funeral plan that they rehearse around all year long, even though they hadn't executed that plan for 12 years. And for the next 6 days, they would honor President Bush here in the Capital Region and in Texas. But every funeral went forward in Arlington National Cemetery, far away from the limelight. As one soldier said, "It doesn't matter whether it's a president or a private, we will be there and be on the marks at the right time for those families." And those families all, almost to a person, were surprised that they hadn't gotten a call that their funeral was going to be canceled. That's the kind of expectations that we place on those young soldiers, the standards to which we hold them. And they do all that on our behalf. Every headstone there tells a story. And the Old Guard is simply the final chapter of the story of those heroes. It's really a story about not only our war dead and what they did to serve us, but us as a nation and the respect and the love that we have for those who have borne those battles. They help teach us about what is best in America and help show our kids about what is best in our nation as well. And in doing so, they help inspire the next generation of warrior as well. Joe Mercer, a cemetery representative who runs funerals and has for 25 years, and before that served at the Old Guard as well, always positions young children at the front of the procession so they can see the reverence that today's soldiers have for their grandfather or their great-grandfather. And he knows that some of them have gone on to serve in no small part because of what he saw that day, just like soldiers go on to serve just because of what they see at the tomb of the unknown soldier. War is a terrible thing. It takes a different kind of person to go fight it. Robert E. Lee said as he watched from the hills above Fredericksburg while his men slaughtered troops from the Old Guard and other Union troops, "It is well that war is so terrible, lest we should grow too fond of it." And it always takes an effort to inspire the next generation of warrior. And what you see happening in Arlington National Cemetery every day is an inspiration to those young warriors. I'll just close with, I think, the best way to sum up the meaning of the Old Guard and Arlington National Cemetery. It comes from Sergeant Major of the Army Dan Daly, the senior enlisted soldier in the United States Army. Foreign leaders come to Washington a lot for consultations and visits. They like to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. One foreign leader with Sergeant Major Daly, they were driving through Arlington. He was looking out the window of the van, and Sergeant Major Daly was explaining to him this history of Arlington and what the Old Guard does. They drove by some troops. They passed soldiers on the caisson horses. And after Sergeant Major Daly finished, he said this foreign military leader continued to look out the window. Without even turning back towards him, he said simply, "Now I know why your soldiers fight so hard. You treat your dead better than we treat our living." Thank you all for letting me share the story with you.
Yeah, we have time for a couple questions or so. Yes, sir.
2 weeks ago, I spoke in your state, in Russellville, and I met your parents. They read my column. They came to my speech. I so appreciate it. It was so humbling. It's just incredible. Thank you.
Thank you.
My question is, we are at that same point right now in our history. We could end up in a civil war. And what will lead us into the war is this equity, this Equality Act that's in the House. I'm wondering, if this reaches the Senate, what is your position?
You know, I think I would quote something that Senator McConnell said about a few other bills, not that one in particular, but I think the same thing would apply, is that he characterized himself as the Grim Reaper of House legislation. So I think that the answer is that, like so many of the extreme and ideological legislation coming out of the House, it just simply wouldn't see the light of day in the Senate. That's also one reason why it's so important that we retain the Senate in the future, because whatever happens with the House of Representatives and the White House, if we hold the Senate, you know, we can put a brake on the worst kind of excesses. If we win the White House, we can continue to do what we're doing now, confirming very high-quality constitutionalist jurists. If the Democrats win it, not only does all that come to an end, but I also wouldn't pass those Democrats to end the legislative filibuster and pass their radical agenda.
Oh, I have a part two to that. So this is very serious. They're going to change civil rights law. There are some saying that there are Republicans in the House that may vote for this, and if they do, we might not have a safeguard in the Senate. So my question is personal and specific. What will you do?
So I'd be surprised if House Republicans support such a radical piece of legislation. The Democrats can pass it on their own regardless. If it comes to the Senate, I will advocate for Senator McConnell not to take any action on it, like we haven't taken action on some of their other radical bills, like the infamous H.R. 1, the Democratic Politician Protection Act, because there's no reason that we should feel compelled to act on the House's radical left-wing agenda. We have our own agenda, one that is actually popular with the American people. That's what we'll continue to advance in the Senate.
Hey, one more quick question.
One more? It's hard for me to see the lights out there, so I can't see hands sticking up. I've been on TV all week long selling my book.
Yeah.
But I'm here to give it away for free to all of you. For free.
What is your favorite Elizabeth Warren story? As a fellow Harvard Law alum.
So I will say this. So Gavin knows that this is honest truth. My very first day, my very first class at Harvard Law, Elizabeth Warren was my teacher. She was a much better professor than she is a senator, trust me. Although she probably thinks I was a better student than I am a senator, and I was not a very good student. Although apparently she was also a better senator than she appears to be a presidential candidate. You know, how can I help but say my favorite Liz Warren study is, you know, the misstep she had last fall when she gave herself a DNA test and came back 1/1024th. Native American. I think the Native American in her bloodlines are so far back that it may have actually been Pocahontas in the 16th century. So, I think you all have a dinner to get to now where you're going to get a copy of Sacred Duty. So again, I just want to say thank you all very much for letting me join you again this year. It's always great to see you.